Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz, and joined as always by Lahav Harkov. And Lahav, how was your Rosh Hashanah? How was the services?
It was very nice. Uneventful.
Chauffeur blowing, kids came, enjoyed.
Yes. First of all, like, it was the first time like my three-year-old really got what was going on, and that was very cute. Mm-hmm. But I choose where to go basically based on where they have a children's service, so I could get at least like maybe half an hour of actually praying. But your family is in a different situation.
No, my kids are older. They actually pray.
Right.
They're the ones who sit in Davin. I'm the one who sits there and reads a book. But
count how many pages are left to the end. I do that a lot.
Yeah. I don't know if I should say how much of the book. I read two books during Davin. But I made some good progress. Let's put it that way. Lots of time. But one thing I'll say, I went to, on the second day, we went to the Old City where my in-laws live. And I went to a services that I've gone to in the past, which is in the Muslim quarter. It's actually an interesting place. It's called Minyan Meshachrei Yerushalayim, the Minyan, or the service of the people who liberated Jerusalem. And the story behind it is it's on the main street of the Muslim quarter called Rehov Hagai, which is basically what connects Damascus Gate to the Kotel, the Western Wall Plaza. And it's a building that was owned pre-1948 by Jews. And then in 1948, as we all know, the Jewish community in the Old City of Jerusalem was evicted because Jordan had won that part of Jerusalem. And the Jordanians proceeded, by the way, to destroy a bunch of synagogues. Like, there's the famous Horva Synagogue in the center of the Jewish quarter that was destroyed and rebuilt just a few years ago. This place was inside a larger building on a floor, was preserved by, I think, a Jordanian who somehow decided to protect it, whatever the circumstances were. And then back in 67, when Israel liberated Eastern Jerusalem and reunified the city, the Jews came back and they said, okay, great, this is our place. So they had this building and these few floors, and they actually gave it over to a yeshiva called the Ateret Kohanim, which some of our listeners might know as being very affiliated with the right wing part of Israeli politics, let's say. But on Shabbatot and holidays, the original minyan takes over the place. So the yeshiva gets to be there during the week. And then on Shabbat and holidays, it's not the yeshiva. Anyhow, why am I telling you all this? Fastest minyan, fastest service you'll ever find in Jerusalem. So if you ever want to know, you can write to me. I'll tell you where it is. It takes 2 hours on Rosh Hashanah. Best place. That's why I go there. Okay. The other reason I go there, it is interesting. You have a fantastic views from the roof of all of the old city. You can literally see into the Temple Mount. It's beautiful and magnificent. But as we finish the service and leave, we walk outside to the main street in the middle of the Muslim quarter. A group of Arab women walk by carrying signs with the pictures of Al-Aqsa and chanting in Arabic. And I don't really know Arabic, but this, anyone who knows a little Hebrew can understand because the words are very similar, saying, with blood and fire, we will liberate or redeem Al-Aqsa. That's the mosque on the Temple Mount. And they were followed by a big group of policemen to make sure that nothing happened. But you could just see, Lahav, the way they were looking at us as we walked out of the Rosh Hashanah service, the hatred in their eyes. And it was scary and it was sad to see that there's such hate for Jewish people. And you know, and for what also? Like, what do they have to liberate Al-Aqsa? What's going on there? Because some Jews want to go up there and pray? No one's threatening. The one country that
even
actually...
the prayers are, yeah, like, you know, what are we talking about? Like, yeah, a few people whispering in
the back.
It's
ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the riots that break out there all the time, I mean, let's also just be honest. The riots that break out there because there are Arab Muslim youth who decide to close themselves inside the mosque and shoot firecrackers and throw rocks and chairs at policemen and Jews who are visiting or praying on the Temple Mount. That's why there's violence there. And the problem is that you have people, leaders in this region, like King Abdullah of Jordan, who gets up at the United Nations last week and speaks in his address to the General Assembly and says, and I'll quote, the rights of churches in Jerusalem are threatened. Christianity in the holy city is under fire. As custodians of Jerusalem's Muslim and Christian holy sites, we're committed to protecting the historical and legal status quo to their safety and future. And nowhere is that more important than in Jerusalem. And this is just a blood libel by a head of state of a country that is on our border, which, by the way, Israel gives amazing amount of security resources, financial resources, energy resources.
It's a fact that King Abdullah's family would not be ruling Jordan if it weren't for Israel. I mean, it's
over. But this guy has no problem spewing lies. And you know what? And here, his lie that he speaks from the United Nations General Assembly plays out on the streets of Jerusalem. Like what I saw on the second day of Rosh Hashanah as I walked out of the services.
Yeah, I've written about this sort of blood libel a few times because I find it really infuriating. I mean, King Abdullah says these things all the time. And I once wrote an article and I was really angry about it, how I felt that Jared Kushner, for example, was like almost encouraging it, because when he was presenting Trump's peace plan, he was like, finally, Muslims will be able to pray at Al-Aqsa as they please. And I'm like, finally? Like, what's been going on since 1967? Where have you been? Like, why are you just letting these people lie? But worse than Kushner, who doesn't have any power anymore, really, is now Yair Lapid. I mean, met with Abdullah like 2 hours after he gave that speech. They were all smiles. The press release for the prime minister's office was really positive. It was about how great relations are between the countries. And I was just like, excuse me, how great can the relations be if you have King Abdullah standing on the UN stage inciting violence against Israel? And we know there's constantly violence. It's not just, I mean, women marching in the street screaming those things is bad enough, but there's actual violence, actual rioting going on very often with deadly results.
With deadly results. And we're actually in the middle right now, where Israel is in the midst of what I don't want to say yet a Palestinian uprising, but there is an escalation in violence in the West Bank as well as in parts of Jerusalem. Attacks have taken place in the Muslim quarter as well as other parts of the old city. They've taken place in other parts of Jerusalem. There was an East Jerusalem Arab who just last week stabbed someone not far from where you live, Lahav, at the Shalit Junction outside of the city of Modi'in. When a leader speaks, and someone who is respected and listened to and claims to be the custodian of holy sites and says that the future of Jerusalem is an urgent concern and undermining Jerusalem's legal and historical status quo triggers global tensions and the holy city must not be a place for hatred and division. Well, King Abdullah, you're the one who's making it a place for hatred and division. And you're the one who's, by spreading these lies, is allowing for this violence, unfortunately, to continue.
And it's just amazing to me because, like, he visits, like, Western capitals and they see him as this, like, enlightened despot type. Like, oh, here's the Arab dictator who we can talk to and be friends with. He's a stabilizing force. As opposed to, say, like, Sisi in Egypt, who's an actual stabilizing force. Neither of these people are, like, great Democrats, right? Like, I understand that Reddit, you know, people don't like Sisi because there's not, like, freedom of press in Egypt. It's not like there's so much freedom in Jordan. And then they pretend somehow that he's so great for peace.
I can understand that he's
you don't have a lot of options.
Right, but still. Right. And I could also understand his situation. He's under pressure. He's got public opinion. He's got a big Palestinian majority within his country. So he's got to speak out occasionally. But there's ways to say things and there are ways not to say things. And when you see violence happening and playing out on the streets of Jerusalem, and then you actively try to stir the pot and get those flames to be even bigger, you stoke the fire or whatever the term is, you are to blame.
Absolutely.
So when I saw those women yelling at us and looking at us with such hatred in their eyes, the first thing I thought to was King Abdullah's speech at the UN. He should be using, I mean, Yom Kippur's not his holiday, but he could use maybe the Day of Atonement to atone for what he did.
To atone and to not do it again. Don't do it again. But I mean, I also feel like we in Israel just, you know, we're like, all we want is stability and quiet, so we just let it all slide. You know, it's like the same with what's going on in Lebanon right now, where I'm not opposed to our negotiations with Lebanon at the maritime border. Like, we have economic interests and we want to just get this over with. But some of the attitude that I've seen towards it is like, we just want Hezbollah to quiet down. We just want whatever. Yeah, okay. If it's not our maritime border and our gas now, Hezbollah will come up with a new reason next week. Like, that's not a reason to do it.
Yeah, well, at least when it comes to the Temple Mount, there has been an improvement in the last couple of years that Israelis are now able to go up there and pray, right? They can't yet wear tefillin or a tallit, but they actually hold services up there.
Yeah, small and not loud, but that's fine. It's a start.
Okay, but it's a huge improvement from the way things were for many years. And I think the status quo is important. I think Israel should try to maintain it as much as possible. But I also think it's ridiculous. And we, you and I have spoken about this a lot in the past, how it's ridiculous that Jews cannot pray in what is our holiest site. And it's not because Jews don't want to. It's because they're being threatened by people like King Abdullah. This is what's going to undermine the region. Come on. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, and I've been up there on the Temple Mount, before, I think it was before 2015, which is around when Israel stopped allowing those screaming women to actually do the screaming on the Temple Mount. So, like, I've been up there where you have these groups of Muslim women who are, like, their faces are mostly covered as well, who just would come up to Jews and just yell at them. And this was before anyone was praying. This is just, like, walking around, you know.
Maybe these were your old friends. They knew that and I know each other. So they
exactly.
Lahav, we came out on the eve of Rosh Hashanah with our annual list of the 50 most influential Jews. And to our listeners, you should check it out. You can find it online at jpost.com, at our website. I think you'll find it interesting, a nice, diverse collection of people who are making a difference in the world. But I wanted to talk to you a bit about our number one choice, which was chosen by the Jerusalem Post editorial board, turned out to be the president of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky.
Surprise.
Surprise.
That was my, I tweeted it. Nobody's surprised, but
no one was surprised, but you wrote the entry. And what's interesting is I got a bunch of emails over the holiday from people who were shocked, as they said as some of them wrote, that we would allow and put a Jew like Zelensky, who's the leader of a country where there were people who were responsible for the massacre of thousands of Jews during the Holocaust in World War II, wears a cross, et cetera, et cetera. How could we put him as the number one choice on the list? So what, I was curious what your thoughts were.
I think that, first of all, like, influential is a value neutral word, right? Like, I know lately when you think of influencers, you think of social media and whatever, but it is a value neutral word. Like, if you're just looking at who had an influence on the world this year, who's Jewish, I just think that you can't argue with Zelensky being number one. Like, who would you put as number one? Our number two is Yair Lapid. I don't think that he, with all due respect to our prime minister, I just don't think he comes even close to Zelensky in influencing the world this year. So that's like for starters. I also think that the article itself wasn't like, he's the most amazing person in the world, blah, blah, blah. Like, I think he's done great things for his country. I think that he's proven himself in a time of challenge, etc. But the article also has criticism of him. For example, his use of the Holocaust in, various imagery and speeches right. that he's made that I think is inappropriate. I mean, I think that what Russia's doing is just as inappropriate, if not more, since they're the aggressor. But, I think that people need to think beyond the, like, do you like Zelensky? Do you not like Zelensky? I understand some people don't like him. And to think about what has happened in the world in the last year and which Jewish people were involved in it.
Yeah, I think, to the case of Lapid, just as an example, we put in the number two slot. Right. The moment you're the prime minister of the state of Israel, that basically means that any decision you make is going to impact probably the largest Jewish community in the world, which is here in the state of Israel. So that definitely gives you a lot of influence, not just as a Jew, but over Jews. With that said, Zelensky definitely has changed the world order, right? This war in Ukraine and the invasion by Russia, the way Russia is now sanctioned, is isolated, the amount of arms that have been sent to Ukraine, the leaders that have gone to Ukraine, the countries that are trying to enter and join NATO as a result of the invasion of Ukraine. It's changed the way it's impacted the energy market and stock market and global inflation and economy. I mean, it's in every aspect of life, no matter where you live today on the globe. And a lot of this had to do with the way that he managed his country, the way he advanced his country's interests, and the way he campaigned for public and international support. So I actually think that it was the right choice. But I'm always happy to get, stir a little controversy. It makes for things to be a little more interesting.
Yeah, definitely. I also just think, like, you mentioned in one of your letters, they said that, like, oh, Ukraine is a country that massacred Jews. True. Sometimes he wears a cross. I think that's referring to the symbol of the Ukrainian army, but whatever. But I don't think that a person has to be a quote unquote good Jew, living a Jewish life the way you or I or whichever reader thinks is a good Jewish life in order to be on this list. I mean, I didn't get a lot of complaints, but one of the complaints I got is that there's at least two people on the list who are not halachically Jewish. And I was just like, well, they're part of our big Jewish family. Like, I think like this list is not supposed to represent like halacha, like Jewish religious law. It's just supposed to be sort of people who present themselves as Jewish to the world. And for example, the astronaut Jessica Meir, whose father is Israeli, but whose mother is not Jewish.
Right.
She really presents herself as Jewish to the world.
She presented herself as the first Jew to be in space. Right. And first Jewish woman.
Okay.
And she might become the first Jewish woman to go on to land on the moon. If she becomes the first woman to land on the moon, because there's yet to be a woman on the moon and NASA now is deciding who they will choose. She is one of the finalists and candidates for that. But the French prime minister, Elizabeth Born, is also the daughter of a Jewish father who was actually a Holocaust survivor and was in concentration camps. So, yes, she is not, according to Orthodox halacha, she is not considered to be Jewish, but she identifies herself as the daughter of a Jewish Holocaust survivor. And that, I think, makes it that we can put her on the list. But the list doesn't mean that we are deciding who is halachically a Jew and who is not halachically a Jew. Although, I don't know, maybe we should take on that role too.
Well, I mean, you were upset. There was a poll, I think this was last week, by the Israel Democracy Institute. So 70% of Israelis don't believe in patrilineal descent. So like, correct, if only your father is Jewish, that you're Jewish. And I had responded to you that like, all Orthodoxy thinks that, but also the conservative movement thinks that. It's relatively new that the Reform movement thinks that.
My point, because what I tweeted was that, and I got a lot of flack for it, but maybe things don't always go over well in a tweet. And that's a lesson for us to learn.
It's not always easy to be clear on Twitter.
Right. Yeah. But my point was to say, because I said it shows a huge success to the rabbinate in this country that this is what most people believe. And the ultra-Orthodox controlled rabbinate I wrote. And people took me to task for that. And my point was that if you have 70% of Israel who doesn't believe in patrilineal descent, that means that the vast majority of the people are secular Israelis, right? These are not Jews who are observant or ultra-Orthodox. These are people who are secular. These are people who drive on Shabbat. These are people who might have a cheeseburger. These are people who might eat seafood, right? These are people who do not follow the letter of the law when it comes to halacha. But this is where they'll say, no, that person is not a Jew. And that person might be someone who's the son or daughter of a Jewish father and identifies themselves as a Jew. But these 70% of Israelis say, no, that person's not Jewish, but now let me have a bite of my cheeseburger. And to me, it was right. Like, yes, that's a success because they've been able to convince people that this is where you draw the line.
I just don't think that the rabbinate is the one who convinced people. Like, I think that that's always been the case in the state of Israel, right? Like, I think that it's the conservative and reform movements or any other sort of alternatives have never been so popular in this country. And it's always been like the synagogue that I go to once a year or the rabbi who will perform, God forbid, my relative's funeral is going to be Orthodox, even though I never go to synagogue.
This goes back.
But it wasn't always Haredi, though. The rabbinate was not always Haredi, right? The prayers that we say for the state of Israel and for the soldiers, which Haredim usually don't say, were written by the rabbinate in the beginning of the, decades ago in the establishment of the state.
So in the last three decades, it's definitely been controlled by the ultra-Orthodox, but to the point of how you're right, the fact that there isn't a reform movement in this country, there isn't a more liberal progressive movement, also is a result of the fact that there is not religious pluralism in Israel in that sense, because
there's no institutional recognition.
Right. They don't have that recognition. So I wonder, but we won't know, but had there been the institutional recognition and they were to see that there are these other options, would we still have a number of 70% or would the number be different? Right. That was the point that I was trying to make, which got lost in how many characters do we get on Twitter these days? 200 and something?
240, I think.
240. Yeah. Can't get all that across in 240 characters on in a single tweet. So I learned my lesson when it comes to wading into very controversial Jewish halacha, patrilineal, matrilineal descent.
Our readers are also very passionate about these issues, I think, for or against, which I find them very interesting as well. But I think the average Israeli, like the Hebrew-speaking Israelis, are a lot less interested. And so sometimes it's interesting to see
what gets people excited.
Yeah, like and the way these issues are covered. I mean, I think that we have very thorough coverage of religion and state issues more than almost any other outlet in Israel. So it's,
I think, because we care about these issues. I mean, look how much we talk about them. But by the way, with this, we could end the topic. But I do want to refer back to last week's podcast. We interviewed Yael Leibowitz, who's a scholar who's actually writing a book on Ezra, right? And as you know, Lahav, Ezra, when he returned to Israel, let's say give or take, I don't know, 2000 plus years ago, and brought the Jews back, and then proceeded, those Jews who returned from Babylonia then built the second temple. One of the things that he instituted was to change from patrilineal descent to matrilineal descent, right? And so basically, for give or take, and these are all rough numbers, for about 2,000 years, the Jewish people went according to patrilineal descent. For the last 2,000 plus years, we've been going according to matrilineal. Maybe it's time to shake things up again after 2,000 years.
You know, with today's technology, I think it's fine if that was what people decided, but it's very hard. We have no Sanhedrin. We have no rabbi. Like, nobody agrees with each other. So that's the problem. No. I think that things like that can't change because there's nothing remotely approaching a consensus on any of these issues.
Not at all. Well, on that note, when it comes to consensus, we will we have a great interview coming up with Tzvika Klein, who's our Jewish World analyst. We speak to Tzvika about a couple of topics. One of them is this great scoop he has on former Prime Minister and current alternative Prime Minister Naftali Bennett and speaking lectures that he's trying to get $100,000 for. So stay tuned for that. We also talked to Tzvika about the Italian elections and how the Jews there look at things and what happened in Uman over Rosh Hashanah. Here we go.
So we have Tzvika Klein here, our Jewish World reporter, who had an interesting scoop recently about alternate Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, who still has a government job, even though it doesn't mean very much. But, you know, technically, he is alternate Prime Minister. He's sitting in on cabinet meetings. But at the same time, there's an agent in the U.S. looking into booking him $100,000 speeches. So, Tzvika, can you tell us a little more?
Hi. So, it's great to be back on the podcast. So, basically, kind of, we slowly were receiving reactions from different Jewish organizations around the world, literally from like three different continents, who approached us and said, you know, we wanted alternate Prime Minister Bennett to speak at our event, whether there's an event before the elections or after the elections. And suddenly either his office approached these organizations and said, you need to speak to this foreign agent in the US, or this agent just approached these Jewish organizations and said, hey, I'm representing Prime Minister or former Prime Minister Bennett now. We're going to charge you $100,000 and it should all be done through us.
So let's just stress the fact that, as Lahav said, he still is an alternate prime minister, which means he's still a minister. A government minister cannot have another job at the same time. And it was very strange for these Jewish organizations when they were speaking to you that they were being told to speak to a person who runs a talent agency and is not a government official when this person is still in government. And they didn't really know how to handle that.
Right. It's a business, right? This is someone who runs a business in the U.S. By the way, legitimate business. He represents lots of Israeli and Jewish, whether journalists or former diplomats. And then suddenly they get approached by this person who claims, and we also know that it's not just a claim, to represent the alternate prime minister. I'll add that in our article, we mentioned pretty much all the dates. The dates that we know of were dates after the upcoming elections. And therefore, kind of the idea was, you know, we're not doing this yet, but when he's finished, then he can speak.
But we don't really know when he's going to be finished because our unfortunate experience of the past few years is that one election doesn't necessarily mean one election. It could mean several. You don't know when a government will be formed.
Exactly.
Although he says, right, that he had planned to resign, remember, immediately when he said he wasn't going to run in politics, and for whatever reason, this was a story in Mariv the other day, he decided to stay on, and now he's staying until November 1st, and then after the election, he's going to resign. So therefore, their defense of this whole thing was that it was all about talks that were going to take place after the election when he would no longer be in office, which doesn't really clear him because you still are a government minister when you're being invited. So either say, listen, I can't talk to you about an event that's going to take place when I'm no longer in government, right? Or, you know, I'm willing to start talking about and potentially scheduling something on paper, but we'll have to talk about the details later. But how do you have a person who doesn't work for a government, who's an agent of a talent agency, reaching out to organizations and talking about money when you're a sitting minister in government? I mean, it doesn't just not look good, it smells bad.
And also many of them were very offended and kind of, you know, saw this as something that was very kind of sleazy, something they didn't expect from Bennett as you know, someone who was very kind of like an honest, you know, considered to be an honest or idealistic politician. Suddenly, you know, they're expected to kind of, you know, start paying these huge sums of money to someone who hasn't even finished, you know, doing what he's supposed to be doing, according to Israeli politics.
And someone who's a millionaire.
Tzvika, wasn't there, there was one organization that was told by this agent that usually we charge $150,000, but because it's you, we'll give you $100,000, right?
Exactly, exactly.
I mean, this right. Also, like, what's usually, he's still in government. <It's>, it's crazy.
The whole right. thing is a very, very strange story. And
I think it's interesting also, sorry, before we wrap this story up, is that, you know, it seemed like Bennett wanted to quit, right? It seemed like he didn't want to be in politics because for about 2 months after he said that he was not running this time, he barely said anything. He had like no involvement. And then suddenly recently he's like picked up his head a bit. So like I reported on this, this thing where Israel's signing on to something called Creative Europe, which is a grant program from the EU for the arts. And it, like all agreements with the EU, it excludes Judea and Samaria, East Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights. But different from Horizon, which is the science program, is that, you know, with the science program, it's basically, you know, there's one Israeli university that's in the West Bank, the rest aren't. And so Israel just sort of made up for it by creating its own grant program for Ariel University, which is the one in the West Bank. But this is something where they could be funding Habima, the National Theater in Tel Aviv, and then Habima would no longer be able to perform in, I don't know, Tzvika's hometown of Efrat if they wanted to put on a show there, which they do. In Israel, most of the big theaters do traveling shows. And so Bennett actually intervened and said to Lapid, it's not appropriate in a interim government for Israel to be signing on international deals like this that exclude, you know, 500,000 Israelis.
Well, he also just has one veto example. Power still, right, under the coalition agreement.
Right, he still has veto power, but there were, it's interesting because in the beginning of the summer, there were some areas where he didn't exercise it, right? Like in the nomination for the, there's the Committee for Senior Appointments, right, for senior government appointments. There's a former Supreme Court judge, Mehdi Mazouz, who is viewed as left-wing, and the right-wing, some of the right-wing people in the coalition didn't want him, and Bennett didn't, including Shaked, who was Bennett's partner for so long, and Bennett didn't say anything. And so it's a very big contrast, I think, on sort of right-wing issues where suddenly he's just decided to wake up. But it's weird that he's waking up and talking about right-wing issues. Oh, and also last week before Lapid gave the speech at the UN, right, Bennett came out against the fact that Lapid was talking about a two-state solution. So it's weird that now, when Bennett's planning for the day after government to make hundreds of thousands of dollars on the speaking circuit, is also the time that he is being active politically again after 2 months of barely saying anything.
And, I mean, being active politically is generous, Lahav. It's more like looking to, I see what you're doing here. Hold on now. I'm a little slow. You're saying becoming active politically and getting on the speaker circuit, maybe that'll help bring in some business?
Maybe, but that makes it even less appropriate, I think.
Just like he disappeared. He was like depressed. You saw him in the pictures. He was like, his body language was, I'm depressed, I'm sad, I'm like, man, I was
during the Biden visit, right? During the Biden visit, it was like, what is he doing there? He was just like the third wheel.
Right. It was anyway.
Yeah, and you could see he felt that way.
Yeah, this whole alternate prime minister thing just doesn't work out so well, right, at the end of the day. But really, I think that Bennett should have known better, made a big mistake. Tzvika blew up a great story, picked up widely by all the local Israeli press because of how strange it was to see someone of that stature doing something like this. He should go out and make money and, you know, live a happy and long life, but you don't do that while you're still in government. And I 100%. Think that hopefully he's learned that lesson, and maybe other ministers in the future have as well. But Tzvika, since we do have you on, and beyond talking just right. about your scoop on former Prime Minister Bennett, you spoke with the Italian Jewish community about Giorgio Meloni's election win, and she looks like she will be the
Prime Minister,
coming Prime Minister in Italy, who is the basically she's someone who has led who leads a very right-wing party, the Hard Right Brothers of Italy party, which has its roots in the fascist party of Mussolini from back in the day. What are the Jews of Italy saying about this?
So that's the thing. It's funny because actually I have a friend, I used to have a roommate that the Lav actually knows, small world, who's Italian. So he's always Avi
like Zia. This is how I know Tzvika, because he lived with my friend Avi, who's from Rome. Anyway, exactly. Yes.
So he's my go-to person to kind of just start understanding this. And he's like, he said, I'll tell you what this person's going to say and what that person's going to say. But he was wrong, actually, which is interesting. So pretty much, you know,
is he still going to be our go-to Italian Jew?
That's yeah, well, you know, he had the right phone numbers. But basically, you know, he assumed that the community would be, you know, look at this very in a very serious way and say, you know, it's look at it very like a very kind of semi-negative or critical way. And actually, you know, the people I spoke to, again, the official Jewish community won't speak out publicly. I did speak to people on background and to the former president of the Jewish community. And they say, you know, it's kind of like what we say here in Israel. It's like the way we see things overseas, you know, from, you know, world media is very different than how Italians see it. And they said it's not really dramatic, and it's not, we're not nervous, and we're not like under pressure. She's actually, you know, Meloni is actually a very good friend of the Jewish community. She was very supportive of Israel. And what they said was that in conversations with heads of the Jewish organizations or Jewish communities, that she understands she has a problem in her party with, you know, activists or people on a local level, that are, you know, that have fascist views and possibly had, you know, connections to pro-Nazi symbols, etc. But she understands that she needs to, you know, clean it up and kind of change the party from within. It kind of reminds me a little bit of like Labour and Corbyn. Just she's not Corbyn. She's, you know, she's the next.
She's getting
leader.
Rid of the Corbyns.
Exactly.
Or the reverse Corbyns.
Exactly. even though what he did mention, the former president of the Jewish community was, she didn't speak about this in her campaign, yet she did promise this behind closed doors. An interesting thing is that she supported a woman, Esther Maeli. I don't know if I'm saying her name correctly, but she was the spokeslady of the Jewish community. And she is now going to be a member of the Senate. So she through Meloni's party. So kind of she did, you know, want to, you know, show the Jewish community and show kind of the more, I would say, center left group in the country that she is not, you know, she's not a fascist, and she supports minorities, etc. So it's an interesting situation there.
You know, I just noticed reading about these things. Well, first of all, I mean, definitely not defending fascism. So I should preface with that. But Italian fascism was not German fascism, and the laws against Jews in Italy in World War II, right, in the time of Mussolini, were instituted when Italy aligned itself with Germany and not before that.
I'm not a big history major, but
I'm not defending it. I still think Mussolini's bad, fascism is bad, but maybe again, I'm not an expert on what's going on today, but maybe it's just less rooted in anti-Semitism, and the ideas that this party was based on were other fascist ideas.
Right. And by the way, something which is fascinating, Lahav, which I don't know, I mean, you probably follow this more than me, but there's this rising star politician who's considered, she's dubbed the AOC of Italy, and her name is Elie Schlein,
who is
a daughter of a Jew. Of a Jew. Maybe she's going to be on our list next year. But she is like very critical of Israel, very progressive. And, you know, and what the community is saying is we're afraid now that the opposition has become, is going to become very extreme against Israel. Definitely if this current prime minister is going to be very pro-Israel, as are many of these extreme right European leaders, like they may become more extreme to the left.
Right.
So that's kind of, that's their fear.
How does Israel view her, Lahav? What is this feeling here? Because I remember there was that Austrian foreign minister that Israel said they're not going to meet and basically boycotted for a bunch of years, because also he came from a party that was also rooted in the Nazis or fascists or whatever it was.
Yes, the Austrian Freedom Party. Those were like literal Nazis. Or the party was started by actual Nazis.
Strache, right? Christian Strache or something.
And within a year, I'm pretty sure it was about a year, he was out because of what Ibiza Gate, which was a big corruption scandal in the Austrian government.
Fine. But the point is that there is precedent to Israel saying we won't talk to people who come from parties that are bad parties.
Right. So Israel's kind of still figuring it out. While we're recording, I mean, she hasn't been sworn in as prime minister yet. She has to make a coalition and everything. I mean, it seems like she probably will, but as we know in Israel, you never know. So Israel's not really saying anything yet, but Israel does have a policy of not associating with, talking to political parties that have Nazi roots. And this is true in Sweden as well, that the far right in Sweden did very well in the last election, and Israel has traditionally not talked to that party. So we'll have to wait and see. I mean, it might really be different if we're talking about the prime minister as opposed to anyone else.
It will be interesting. And it's interesting how the Jews, I mean, Tzvika's point of how the Jewish community is, it looks at things differently is, you know, probably makes sense. People always tend to look at things a little different. I mean, there was also, look, remember back in the day with Donald Trump, there were his refusal to kind of distance himself from the likes of David Duke and what was that group called? The good guys, the bad boys. Was there some?
Oh, yeah, there was, yeah.
The Proud Boys. The Proud Boys.
The Proud Boys. Thank you. The Proud Boys.
Yeah.
And you know, things like that raised concern, but people in the end said, "But he's not an anti-Semite, but he might have some associates who move in those directions or who are anti-Semites." It's always a little more complicated than I think that people tend to look at it. So
I'll just add the Italian Jewish community, 30,000 Jews. Okay. So it's not a very big Jewish community, but it's got it's got lots of history and roots. Great place. We should all meet there for a drink very soon.
Tzvika, one last topic we wanted to talk to you about, Uman. So lots of Jews made it there for the holiday, right? They tend to go. It's the pilgrimage to Rabbi Nachman of Breslov's gravesite. And
in Ukraine.
In Ukraine.
For those who aren't familiar.
Right. It's basically it's a way for husbands to avoid having to clean up any of the Rosh Hashanah meals or watch their kids over Chag.
I was actually there. I was there actually on Rosh Hashanah.
There you go. You're one of those husbands. Wait, on Rosh Hashanah?
I was single and I got married a year later. That's one of those things they say, if you come, right? It's a thing. If you come on Rosh Hashanah, then you're supposed to get married within a year. So it was a little bit more than a year. It was like a year and a few months, but yeah.
Anyway, wow. So you believe in this experience. Stuff.
Magic. Tzvika.
I didn't say I believe in this stuff, but it's a very powerful experience.
I was there when I was 17 and I did not get married within a year. Just putting that out there.
Yeah, it was 2 years later.
But what happened in the end? People went, people got there, they made it.
I mean, again, I know I have a friend whose husband was there like 2 months ahead of time. Like they're, you know, people who are part of the Chassidut of Breslov are so into this, and this is like the highlight of their year. So many of them spent the entire summer there. And you said these are people who didn't want to wash the dishes for Rosh Hashanah, so they didn't wash the dishes for 2 months.
Wow.
And that's because, you know, all these reports pretty much said Ukrainians won't let them in, or Israel won't let them go there, etc. You know, and as Lahav mentioned, this is Ukraine. There is a war. There was a report that we actually picked up, the Jerusalem Post picked up from Ma'ariv, saying how there were these drones sent, Russian drones,
right?
That were sent, you know, to these areas. Some of them were supposed to kind of, you know, be suicide drones and explode on, you know, on civilians or on soldiers. Supposedly these drones were, you know, manufactured by Iran. So that's a report that has been seen. I don't have any necessarily like any proof to this report, but it's definitely kind of adds to the mystery of Uman.
Well, thank God it passed quietly and people were able to go. Pray, come back. Do we know if Eliezer Berland was able to make it in? That would make for an issue.
I read that they weren't letting him in.
Right. I think he didn't get in. But again, there were a few hundred people, if I'm not mistaken, who actually needed some sort of medical help. So like again, you know, luckily no one was killed or, you know, injured because of the war. But, you know, it's a very dodgy area. It's a tiny village. It's taken over by tens of thousands of Jews every year, and it's
a chavaya, it's an experience. Well, Tzvika, great for having you on the show. Thanks for everything and for the insight.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. We wish you a meaningful Yom Kippur. May you be inscribed in the Book of Life, and we will be back next week.